The Senate Judiciary Committee will come to order. Today is Friday, March the 12th, and let the record reflect that we have a quorum present. The first item on the agenda is Senate File 2876, Senator Kubley. Good morning, Senator Kubley.
Yeah, good morning, Madam Chair. I understand you folks were here kind of late last night, but Senate File 2876 does have an amendment. Should we take that amendment first, Madam Chair?
Sure.
It's the A1 amendment. The amendment, Madam Chair and members, attempts to deal with some of the issues that were raised by the department. They're talking about not being able to transfer, inmates at Moose Lake, that they would need to take them from some other facilities. And so this amendment would allow that to happen. And it also allows for the transfer of employees who might be displaced by a temporary action that would need to take place should the facility be remodeled to handle the treatment beds that are implied in this bill.
Senator Olson moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment to put the bill into the shape the author would like it to be in. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members. This was an attempt to deal with a prison that is privately owned that is in my district that closed due to a lack of inmates. They said they needed to maintain the numbers at least 300, and when they dropped below that, they said they could not operate the facility at a profit. But there were a number of people who lost their jobs, Madam Chair and members, and this is an attempt to try and find a way to deal with it that, it bothered me, frankly, that, we're solving an employment problem in one area but creating a problem in another area of the state. And I tried to deal with that by putting Subdivision 3 in on the amendment that would at least allow for the reemployment of some of those folks in a fairly judicious manner. But, with me today is Mayor Ron Ronning of the City of Appleton, and I'd like to ask him to give some testimony on the effect that this closing has had on their city.
Mayor Ronning, welcome to the committee. And I should tell you that I grew up in Appleton, Wisconsin.
I wanted to make sure that clear that it's Appleton, Minnesota.
That's
I appreciate
right.
that.
That's right.
But I can sure I like the name Appleton, so.
Well, welcome to the committee. Thank you for making the trip here.
You bet. I thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to talk to you. I've been mayor of Appleton, Minnesota for approximately 10 years. I'm also a good old military retiree of 22 years. And I'm here to, and I know you've heard tough times within the area, of the state of Minnesota and around the country, but in proportion to Appleton's size of approximately 1,700 people and an elderly makeup in the community, I think that some of the effects that the prison closing in Appleton of a capacity of 1,640 inmates being empty results into 300 to 400 jobs that have been let go at this time. As of February 2nd, the facility closed. Of that 350 to 400 individuals, 50% of those staff members lived in the community of Appleton. The other 50% lived outside the community, which affects it also in the areas of Ortonville, Madison, Benson, Dawson, Montevideo, Bellingham, Wilmer, and Morris and other small communities in a five-county area out there.
Madam Chair, there's a lot of conversations going on this room right now.
Can we please take our conversations outside, please? The members can't hear. Thank you. Sorry, Mr. Mayor. Please continue.
Being an old first sergeant, I hope I'm loud enough and you can you can hear me. But we're finding the devastating effect that we're just starting to experience, and what we're going to experience in the next year or two is going to be vast and very heavily upon our population. As you know, PCF, Prairie Correctional Facility, is the biggest employer in the area, one of the biggest employers. And with those numbers of layoffs, it can be pretty substantial. It's like a domino effect within our community of loss of housing. I've recently received letters of houses that are being foreclosed on, the sales of homes, and also the revenue from the homes falling in valuation is going to cause us problems in the tax base also. Since 1992, since 93, when the facility opened up, it's going to be, we've established a number of businesses throughout our community. Anything from, to us in our small community, a Subway is big. So bear with, motel, handy stops, pizza, mechanical places, a number of new businesses in our community that right now are suffering and starting to lose money already, and also looking at the possibilities of layoffs in our community. We have a number of employees that have transferred out of the state to other Corrections Corporation of America facilities, leaving their families in the community of Appleton and the surrounding communities that they could not afford to take with them so that they can keep up with their insurance and make sure there's a payroll coming into their families. The city of Appleton itself will suffer substantially. CCA, Corrections Corporation of America, I suppose I shouldn't use, contributes $1.1 million to this community of 1,700 people annually, $400,000 to $500,000 in wastewater and water through the city, and the rest of it through taxation. On top of that, we are looking at $350,000 worth of LGA cuts in 2009 and 2010 in our community. This can potentially take 50% of our budget or more in our community and will be devastating to the community. Also, the assessment of the prison itself, we know over the next 2 to 3 years is going to drop immensely. And when that assessed at $43 million in this year, we know that will drop by at least $10 million, which will cause the city of Appleton, which was maxed out on its levy to its community with that assessment, will pay back over $200,000 from the city back to the company. Also, the LGA reductions with our inmates brought into the census was over 1,000. We will lose that also in cuts. I hear from a lot of the mayors from around the community that it's starting with the loss of income in the other communities will start to take its effect. But the city of Appleton will be the most devastated along with Swift County. I also have heard from being on the Rural Development Commission in the six-county area out in Appleton, the school boards will start to lose students, and the aid to the schools is going to be substantial, especially at Lacaparo High School and the elementary school. I know you've heard a number of tough times within our area, but I believe that this is, with the numbers and the proportionate numbers, is going to be very difficult for this community. And I'm asking for your support in this bill and the displacement of inmates to Prairie Correctional Facility. At least we can bring people back to work. We can bring back things to the community and give us some positive hope. I'm very optimistic that the state of Minnesota and the corrections people are very supportive of our facility. We've worked with them very well over the years with the state of Minnesota. We understand that their projections for the years of adding on and revamping their facilities and bringing inmates back was a positive thing for them, but a negative thing for us with the economy the way it is throughout the United States. And I'm very optimistic that I know this group and the state will really work with us and try to bring those jobs back, or at least some, so that we can gain contracts or work with Minnesota in the future. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Any questions? Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Madam Chair. Mr. Mayor, I sit on the Health and Human Services Committee, so this is an issue, the cost of treating sex offenders, that we've spent quite a bit of time discussing. And I'm sure Senator Kubley has also told you that this has been part of our debate with regard to the bonding bill. Senator Kubley and I actually had this discussion at the beginning of session where we talked about the fact that, you know, he has a prison in his district. I was hearing from some local governments in my district. Why are we talking about putting additional tens of millions of dollars into building a new facility when there's room available out in other areas of the state for things that are being underutilized? And so, you know, I commend Senator Kubley for bringing this idea forward, but I would have to say that as we've moved through session with the bonding bill, the governor has really required us, in order to pass a bonding bill, to put the emphasis on expanding the facility at Moose Lake. A lot of us thought we should at least wait and have a little bit broader discussion about whether that was such a good idea before we move forward. So I just wanted to raise that point to kind of put this in the context of what's been happening down here at the Capitol. And to some degree, we may be a little bit locked in, or at least have less room to have that broader discussion because of having to negotiate or make some compromises with the executive branch. But I also wanted to ask a question about the bill. I'm assuming, you know, we have kind of two sets of sex offenders right now in terms of the population that we are paying to support. One is the population that's incarcerated in prison, and the other is the population that's too dangerous to release that we're keeping for treatment purposes. And I'm wondering which of those populations you are talking about dealing with at your facility. Because you're talking about transferring to the Commissioner of Human Services, I'm wondering if you're not talking about the people who are kept for treatment, but at the same time, you're talking about the language has to do with incarcerated, and I don't think we're incarcerating those people. So I'm a little confused about what your expectation there would be.
Senator Kubley?
Well, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, I guess it was my intent, Prairie Correctional Facility in Appleton is not set up, I don't think, to take sex offenders, but that we would transfer inmates from the state system that would allow for rehabbing of beds at the prison facility that would allow us to, you know, begin the treatment process while they're incarcerated instead of waiting until they're released. I know that's done with some of them now from visiting with Senator Higgins. But, it seems to me that we could do that more across the board. But it was not my intent to transfer any of the sex offender population to the Appleton facility. I do think that some of the reasons that Commissioner Crist gave me as inefficiencies in operating two facilities, those things already exist within the state system. We don't even have all the sex offenders at one location. We've got them at St. Peter. We've got them at Moose Lake. It seems to me that we're already doing some of the things that cause inefficiencies in the system. I guess it was my intent to, you know, rehab some of the beds at the prison that would allow us to keep all of the sex offenders at one facility so that we would not have, the running of separate support functions that would increase per diems, or having, two sets of rehab services at different facilities that increases per diems. I mean, those are inefficiencies that the department visited with me about, and yet, those inefficiencies are already in our system. So I guess it's my intent that we would bring some of those inefficiencies out of the system by locating them all in one place.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, so Senator Kubley, in Subdivision 1 of your bill, Section 1, Subdivision 1, what's the thinking for transferring 50% of the...
Well, Madam Senator Chair and Senator Olson, I guess, you know, it was my intent originally to do the rehab to the beds at the Moose Lake facility so that you could then, you know, do the treatment as well as incarceration at the Moose Lake facility. I don't know, you know, I think there are adequate beds at the Moose Lake facility to do both of those. How long into the future that would be the case, I don't know. But it seems to me that that's a population that's increasing. And if there's a possibility that some of the lower level sex offenders might be released under certain conditions, it seems to me it would save the state a lot of money if we could get that started during their incarceration instead of waiting until they're released and have to go through the civil commitment process. Now, I think you'll hear, you know, reasons why the department doesn't think you can do that when they testify. But, you know, it still seems to make sense to me that if we had them all in one facility, it would be, you know, give our system the best efficiency that we could have.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Senator Kubley, I don't disagree with that concept. I guess what I'm just trying to understand is, you know, we have kind of, like I said, two distinct populations, and I think that for those who are incarcerated, their budget for caring for them, whether they're getting treatment or not, really has to be with the correctional, you know, the Department of Corrections, and that Human Services picks up and takes over control at the point where they then become committed for treatment. And I don't know that you could somehow overlap those two or change that without, because I don't know how Human Services would manage the budget for people who are actually incarcerated.
It would seem, Madam Chair and Senator Olson, it would seem to me that it would be best to transfer the authority to one department or the other for the entire facility. It would probably have to go to corrections. But, you know, some of the people that work with the sex offender program would then have to be transferred to the department as well. So I think the details can be worked out, but, you know, I know there are other opinions out there as well.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Kubley, what I see is something that is trying to give the Department of Corrections some kind of a place to fill up in your communities. And I think it's certainly commendable that you and the mayor and others are fighting for your community. But this facility is not designed for the kind of use that you're proposing in this document. And I just think that that we can't just take up an old prison that never was designed for proper use, and it is no better now. So I really don't know why we're even considering this. It didn't go through the bonding commission, and as far as I can see, it shouldn't go through this one.
Well,
Senator Cooper.
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, I guess, you know, it just, you know, again, you know, I realize that it's not set up for that at the moment, and that's why I was talking about it. But I don't see any reason why, you know, the bonding dollars that were appropriated, I think there is $47 million in the bonding bill, that those beds could be rehabbed with that amount. You know, it would certainly be cheaper, it would seem to me, than, you know, starting over and building an entirely new facility. Now, you know, you may you're an attorney and I'm not, you know, so there may be legal ramifications that I've not thought of, but I guess I'm just trying to look at ways that we can bring the best efficiency to the system to get the kinds of services that are needed for these inmates and for the state as a whole.
Mr. Mayor, when the facility shut down, how many jobs were lost?
We lost jobs December 1st, February 2nd, so a total, our capacity, what we've had in the past, is 378 full-time positions in the facility. I'm also, just by the way, I'm a 16-year employee of the facility also, served numerous positions. If I may say, just so you know who the staff is there, this is one of the most senior staffs in throughout Corrections Corporation of America, and is rated as one of the top three in the nation.
So. Ms. Mayor, if only 50% of the facilities are going to be up and running, how many jobs restoration would that be?
I believe, and I can't speak for the corporation, but I know the last layoff was a result of 110 employees on February 2nd and 120 prior to that on December 1st. So somewhere in that 200 figure, at least, and I can't speak for them, probably would be able to resume some sort of work at the facility with the numbers at 500.
Mr. Mayor, thank you for making the trip. Any other questions for Mr. Mayor before I let him go? Thank you. We have other individuals who would like to testify on the bill. Mr. Carlson and Mr. Henderson.
Madam Chair, my name is Terry Carlson.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Ms.
Okay.
Carlson.
It happens all the time. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for the Department of Corrections, and I am wondering if it's possible to ask Dan Storkamp, the Deputy Director for MSOP, to come to the table at this time as well.
Absolutely. Mr. Henderson, can I replace you for a second? Thank you. Ms. Carlson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. While we appreciate the amendments that you offered, Senator Kubley, allowing offenders from other facilities to be transferred to the Prairie Correctional Facility and the provision to assist the staff that would be laid off with a downsizing of the correctional facility at Moose Lake, we still have some concerns with the language as we understand it. What we understand is that the Department of Human Services has staffing sufficient for their existing and projected client population in the next few years, and so we would be very concerned that we'd have significant layoffs of correctional staff at our facility. They use different classifications than we use in the prisons, and so that's one of our concerns. The other is that we released from the Moose Lake prison about 350 offenders on an annual basis. And offenders are not released from the Prairie Correctional Facility to the streets, so we'll have increased transportation costs if we decrease the size of the prison population at the Moose Lake prison from a current capacity of 1,029. So half of that would be 515 approximately. So we'd have additional transportation costs. And the other thing that I just feel the need to talk about is our population management plan. We will eventually need all the beds at Prairie Correctional Facility to deal with our population growth over time. At this point, with population projections as they are, we anticipate that in July of 2012, we will begin to again house offenders at Prairie Correctional Facility until we reach capacity at that facility. If we lose 515 beds in our system at the correctional facility at Moose Lake, we will fill the Prairie Correctional beds sooner, and as a result, we project a need to bond for additional Department of Corrections beds as early as 2014 for occupancy in 2017. And, you know, just rough estimate, we probably would need $30 to $35 million for those additional beds. if things stay as they are with our current capacity within our system and Prairie Correctional Facility as an option later down the road, we anticipate that we won't need to bond for additional male prison beds until after 2018. The other thing that I want to talk about, and also Dan Storkamp will add, is that there are some significant operating challenges to having two different client populations in this correctional facility at Moose Lake. And so I'll turn it over to you, Dan.
Mrs. Storkamp, welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair and members, for the record, I'm Dan Storkamp, the Deputy Director of the Minnesota Sex Offender Program. And we, too, understand Senator Kubley's bill and what he's trying to do. But as we understand it, there is going to be some operational issues and inefficiencies, as Assistant Commissioner mentioned. As any time that you bring two programs together on one site, and we were actually over at Department of Corrections in two of their facilities for a period of time, they created a lot of inefficiencies of duplication of services, as well as inefficiencies and operational issues of how do you manage a organization, for instance, perimeter control, when one of the populations are inmates who have a different way of managing that escape than somebody who's in a civil commitment program. So we'd have to work through several of those type of issues. In addition, anytime you create an additional site, and I know Senator Kubley had mentioned this as well, we do have two sites currently, and that is some of the reason that our per diem is as high as it is. But adding a third site, regardless if it's at Moose Lake or elsewhere, it is going to create duplication of efforts or duplication of services that we'd have to identify. And even the transportation between the two sites is about a mile and a half by road, and as such, if we're either moving food or staff or clients, those are the type of factors that we'd have to consider as we looked at this type of a proposal. Anytime that you take a client outside of a facility, even if it's for a short duration, considerations of public safety are always there. I think the Assistant Commissioner also talked about the staffing issue. In Moose Lake, the civil commitment program, currently we have a security staff for the current population and what we're anticipated for 2012 until we run out of beds. What we really need for staffing between now and then are the clinical components and treatment components and staff around that area. And those are, while Department of Corrections has a few of those type of classifications, it's not the majority of the classifications I think that they're currently talking about. And I think those I'd stand for questions.
Deputy Commissioner, Mr. Storkamp, so let me see if I understand this right. The transfer, the potential transfer of, say, 50% of the population to Prairie will mean that there will be jobs. People will be hired to staff up to work with that 50% transfer. But that doesn't necessarily mean that we are automatically going to be able to fill the 50% void at the other facility, so there'll be job cuts at the other facility. And what I'm hearing you say is that the job cuts at the other facility may never come back because the new hires will not be in the same category of jobs as the people who lost their job as a result of the transfer?
Madam Chair and members, that is correct. Even in the security class, we don't hire correctional
officers.
Thank you. We deal with security counselors, and their roles are slightly different in functions, while they have many of the similar type of things. But we wouldn't be hiring security counselors right away. Security counselors would be hired as we need additional beds above our current capacity, which would be well past 2012.
I think I understand. Thank you. Any questions for Deputy Commissioner Carlson or Mr. Storkamp? Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Now, Mr. Henderson. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Tim Henderson. I am an AFSCME Council 5 field representative and a formal correctional officer with over 19 years of state service. Until recently, I was a president of our AFSCME Correctional Policy Committee and the national representative for AFSCME Corrections United. I'm here this morning to oppose Senate File 2876, which would transfer inmates from Moose Lake Correctional Facility to the private prison in Appleton, Minnesota. Ask Me Council 5 believes that public safety is a core responsibility of government. Private companies should not profit from prisons. Our safety should not be sold to privateers. Private prisons do not save taxpayers' money. They do cut corners. Private prisons often will not handle inmates with the serious medical or behavior problems or will charge the public jurisdiction for their costs. In fact, that was explicitly the arrangement with Appleton. Challenges identified include the cost of health care, mental health issues, and drug offenders. Contracting with a prison that has the explicit right to refuse inmates with these problems is an inadequate way to address these challenges. Private prisons, including Appleton, often provide less programming for inmates. The private prison industry also has a mixed safety record. They have encountered serious legal problems and have seen more than its share of financial ups and downs. There are numerous studies and even more numerous anecdotes to support these assertions. See Corrections Corporation of America, a critical look at its first 20 years. In addition, once a jurisdiction contracts out a function, it loses control. Finally and fundamentally, a jurisdiction should be very concerned about turning over such a critical governmental responsibility to a for-profit company. Depriving a person of their freedom is a very serious matter, not something that should be left to the lowest bidder. We know that prison funding has not kept up with sentencing policies. This is a dilemma many other states are also facing. Some have dealt with the dilemma by utilizing private prisons. Many have come to regret that. Some have revoked their contracts, and in some cases, private companies decided to discontinue operating facilities. Some of our DOC members from Moose Lake are here today. The bill before you today would require that many of them would be laid off if this proposal was enacted. Madam Chair and members of the committee, we ask that you oppose Senate File 2876 and keep Minnesota safe and secure through our public correctional facilities. Thank you for the opportunity to testify, and thanks for the hard work you all do.
Mr. Henderson, have you been able to obtain any information about if the 50% transfer does happen, what the potential loss of job would be at Moose Lake?
I don't have that information in front of you today, but I can provide it.
Ms. Carlson or Mrs. Storkamp, do you have that number? I'm sorry, I should have asked that question when you were up here.
Madam Chair, currently the Moose Lake Correctional Facility has an employee complement of 343 FTEs. We have not calculated and done a specific plan of what we would need to retain with a 50% reduction, but we know that it would be more than half because we need to keep an administrative infrastructure in place to deal with the facility. So that's the best I can answer at this point.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Henderson from members of the committee? Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, I'm concerned about the cost factor and my role in that with my committee. And I guess I look at this and, we went through that whole process when the Appleton facility was designed and built and whatever, and CCA has a very kind of shaky operation that I don't think that we're going to be moving in this direction. This, as the man from AFSCME is talking about, they're dealing with something that does not fit in with the correction plan. And I would leave it at that.
Mr. Henderson, thank you. Well, Senator Kubley, I certainly can appreciate the position that you're in, and having the mayor come, he certainly makes a compelling argument. But I don't know how we net a win here.
it feels to me like to get the jobs to the folks in your neighborhood is going to result in some job loss in Senator Lori's neighborhood. And, you know, that's a tough position to be in. And
yeah,
I certainly can appreciate
Madam
that.
Chair, I guess that is the reason that I had asked that Subdivision 3 on the amendment be added. You know, it does seem to me that, you know, if you're just trading places in the state where unemployment takes place, we haven't gained anything. But, you know, I was hoping that there might be space for some of the workers in other locations, or that they might be able to fill in for people who retired over a fairly short length of time. I don't know how long that would take to utilize everyone who lost out at Moose Lake. So that's certainly a consideration, Madam Chair.
Yeah. Well, Senator Kubley, I've heard the discussion from the committee members, and I can kind of sense a direction where people are at. What would you like us to do with your bill?
Well, if it were up to me, I guess I'd move it forward. But, you know, I can understand your reluctance as well. So, you know, I'm open to your suggestion, Madam Chair. I don't know.
Well, Senator Kubley, I think that it's in the committee. Let's leave the bill in the committee for now, and let's see what happens. Certainly, if things changes between now and the end of the session, there's an opportunity for us to come back and relook at this. We can certainly send it to the Rules Committee if we need to do that. But my sense is that the mayor has come from such a distance to be with us today, and I know your folks at home would like us to do something for them. And I guess I don't I'd rather leave the bill in the committee so that we are preserving at least an opportunity to revisit it than voting it down,
Senator
Kubley. So we'll lay the bill on the table for the time being.
Okay. Well,
thank you, Senator Kubley.
Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Senator Scoy just walked in. Senator Scoy, Senate File 2614.
Actually, Madam Chair, I had the pleasure of listening to the previous bill, which was interesting. But I am here with Senate File 2614. This is an effort to clarify liability responsibilities on semi-trucks and trailers. This is the third committee stop for this bill, so we have had a pretty good discussion about it. And as I look at the bill, it doesn't seem to be much controversy with Section 1, mostly it's current law. In Section 2, as we move down through line 1.19, most of that is the revisor's change to make the language more readable, and the discussion has revolved around the last four lines in that paragraph from line 1.2 to 1.23, and this is an effort to clarify that the operator of a semi, who is the individual that does the inspection before the truck leaves the yard, is the responsible party, the agent of the owner, and the owner of the tractor, and therefore the liability would be with the owner of the tractor, and that and the who is the operator. And I am here with Ms. Backus and Mr. Grawl, and they will add to my introduction.
Welcome to committee, Ms. Backus.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Amber Backus, and I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Trucking Association, a statewide organization representing motor carriers of all sizes and the vendors that serve the trucking industry. And I appreciate you indulging us in hearing this issue. We did have a little bit of discussion with regard to the definition of motor vehicle last year in this committee, and we are back with a bill this year to talk about that a little further and just to have some qualifying language about that definition. For a little bit of background, this provision regarding the vicarious liability when the driver is acting for somebody else has moved around in statute. And in 2005, it was moved into Chapter 169, which has a definition of motor vehicle that's limited to the self-propelled portion of a motor vehicle. But for 31 years between 1974 and 2005, there was no definition of motor vehicle in statute for this vicarious liability provision. Last year's bill that you heard would have moved the definition back, or referenced the definition in 65B, which is the no-fault definition, which says a motor vehicle is the tractor, the self-propelled part, and includes a trailer. And the case law over that time when there was no statutory definition did reference the definition of 65B as the definition of the vicarious liability statute. But oftentimes, having the trailer provided to the link to the vehicle so that action could be taken over the owner of the self-propelled part. What's a little different now is there's a case pending called the V case, which is seeking to hold the trailer owner vicariously liable for the negligent driver's actions. And without some qualifying language as that's in this bill saying the tractor and trailer are one motor vehicle for liability purposes, we're a little nervous about what would happen if the V case were to proceed in terms of what the courts have decided so far. And with that, I'll turn it over to Doug Groff from DART Transit to speak a little more about the V case and its implications.
Mr. Groff, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members of the committee, for granting me the opportunity to speak today. As stated, my name is Doug Graw. I'm in-house counsel for DART Transit Company here on behalf of the Minnesota Trucking Association. The V case, what it could mean to our industry is motor carriers maintain the public liability. Motor carriers are the ones that protect the public in the event of injuries and in the event our vehicles are involved in accidents. But trailer owners don't maintain auto liability insurance. They don't. They're not responsible for the public. They're only going to be responsible for property damage on their own trailer. That's the only insurance they're going to be given. This would basically throw that all up in the air and make trailer owners responsible for what the drivers of the trucks do. The drivers of the trucks are selected by the motor carriers, or in the event we're not talking about the motor carrier industry, are selected by whoever owns that car, the self-propelled portion. The trailer owner doesn't get into the driver selection process. It doesn't dictate who's going to be inspecting the equipment, who's going to be operating the equipment. It doesn't actually govern whether or not there's going to be an accident at all because it has no control over the scenario. And that's what the Safety Responsibility Act was originally intended to do, was to provide that the owners who have the control over the vehicles would be held responsible. What, as stated earlier, Minnesota case law thus far has not found a trailer owner liable as a trailer owner for the tractor's actions. There's one case that's been brought up a handful of times, and that's the National Indemnity versus Ness case. It uses a famous quote referring to the debate over whether a trailer caused an accident or a tractor caused an accident is not something the court wants to get into. But that same court also said that there has to be some kind of an actual connection between the use of the vehicle and the actual accident. And in that case, the facts of that case had nothing to do with whether or not it was the trailer owner's responsibility. It had to do with bobtail insurance, which is when a truck is not attached to a trailer, versus a motor carrier's auto liability insurance policy. The motor carrier was ultimately held responsible. As I stated earlier, motor carriers are responsible to the public because they do control those trailers. For those reasons, we'd ask that you support the bill and continue to support that the owners of tractors be held responsible.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, I carried the bill last year that I think is basically Section 1 of this bill, and it passed the Senate last year and so over the House. Now, what hasn't been said, I mean, it was said that what happened was the legislature recodified a section of law that had virtually nothing left in it related, and one of the, it was a definition of motor vehicles, which was then moved, and that section was closed out. It was moved over into Chapter 169, which, by the way, already had its own definition, so that created some confusion. The V case, which was not pointed out to us, said, and the district court said, the legislature must have had some reason for doing so. The legislature didn't have any reason for doing so. It was just renumbered. Now, it's also not been said that this is on appeal right now, and it passed the Senate. It's sitting over the House of Representatives, I think because we're waiting to see what the appellate courts are going to do with this. And I haven't been able to pay attention recently, so perhaps counsel can, or perhaps the witnesses can tell us where it sits in the Court of Appeals right now, rather than talking about the, you know, selectively pointing out some of the, your facts. Why don't you just tell us what the status is in the Court of Appeals?
Sure.
Ms. Backus.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, I'd be happy to. This summer, on July 14th, 2009, the Court of Appeals affirmed the decision of the lower court and found, in fact, that the vicarious liability statute does not provide a basis to impose vicarious liability on semi-trailer owners for the actions of semi-truck trailers. No further filings have been happened at this case, but at the same time, the motor carrier did offer a settlement to the plaintiff, and a check has been cut, but there hasn't been a release on that, and I'm thinking that's maybe waiting for the legislature to potentially change this definition to 65B without the clarifying language, which would then sort of undo the decisions it's made to date in the lower court and the appeals court.
So, Madam Chair, Ms. Backus, what's different between this bill and the bill that the Senate passed last year that is currently sitting in the other body?
Certainly.
Ms. Backus.
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, there is a little cleanup language by the reviser in this version this year, but this bill incorporates your bill, Senate File 251, and that is the language found on lines 1.19 and 1.20 through Subdivision 2. So the language saying, for purposes of the subdivision, motor vehicle has the meaning given in it in Section 65B.43, Subdivision 2. That is your legislation from last year. Our clarifying language is then in the first section, saying that in the combination of a single self-propelled vehicle and one or more trailers is considered a single motor vehicle for purposes of this definition, as well as clarifying language in the second portion of Section 2, which is the language on 1.20 through 1.23. But it does incorporate your legislation from last year in terms of the reference to
How is this changing the bill that we passed last year?
Ms. Backus?
Madam Chair, Senator Betzold, so again, it's the language in Section 1 and the end, and so it's just saying that for liability purposes, that tractor and trailer together are one motor vehicle, and a driver is acting as the agent of the owner of the self-propelled portion, not the trailer.
Okay. Ms. Backus, so is that changing what we did last year, or is just further clarifying what we did last year?
Madam Chair, it's our attempt to further clarify what was done last year and to reflect how the trucking industry has operated since the implementation of the Safety Responsibility Act in the 40s. Relationships with insurers and brokers and interchange agreement with shippers all have that liability expectation on the owner of the tractor, the motor carrier, who's operating the vehicle together.
Very good. Any further questions for these two witnesses? Yeah. Senator Betzel.
I believe Mr. Carlson also should testify. So if he has, okay.
I see him standing there. And I was just trying to finish with these two witnesses, and then I will bring him up. Very good. Thank you both very much. Mr. Carlson?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Joel Carlson, I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Association for Justice, and I've learned more about the definition of a motor vehicle than I ever cared to know. Madam Chair, I brought my paper clips because last year we talked about linking the two together, and that has always been the case. And Section 1 of this bill, which has nothing to do with the V case at all, simply restates what has been the law since 1932, that a tractor and its trailer are one unit as it relates to causing an accident. That's exactly what we said last year, and that is what the law has been since 1932. Section 2 of the bill is, in part, Senator Betzold's bill, which goes back to the definition of a motor vehicle, which has been in place since 1945. However, on lines 1.20 through the end of the bill, absolutely changes the law as it relates to who is responsible for an accident. Or I should say, not responsible for an accident, but who is potentially able to pay for damages that they cause. And what this says is that the trailer owner has no liability to the public. And that is not the law. That is not what the law has been since 1932. And we have problems with that bottom portion of Section 2. I also want you to know that the V case is not pending. It is decided. It was decided by the Court of Appeals. Review has been denied by the Supreme Court. It was sent back to the District Court in Hennepin County, and judgment was entered last November on the V case. It is not pending. It is decided. It is the law. And the law right now, unless we put into law Senator Betzold's bill, which is on lines 1.19 to 1.20, right now a trailer is not a motor vehicle for the purposes of liability, period. And that is a problem that needs to be fixed. And we would like the committee to to look at whether or not, by reason of ownership, which has been the law since we've had this law in 1945, by reason of ownership, whether or not you are responsible to the public. And it is not the case that the V decision somehow changed that. What changed the law was a simple renumbering in 2005 that put the Safety Responsibility Act into 169. Unintended. I've listened to every word of the tape. There's not one single mention that said we're going to change vicarious liability, we're going to change direct liability. That didn't happen. Senator Betzold's bill just puts the definition back in place that has been there since at least 1945. And we have problems with the bottom portion of this bill, not Section 1 and not Section 2 up to the definition, but how you change the owner's responsibility as it relates to a motor vehicle is a change in the law that has not been the case since 1945. Ma'am Chair, happy to answer questions, but this is a nettlesome issue, I understand, but this is not what the law has been.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm a little surprised, but maybe I shouldn't be, at Mr. Carlson's response, because while he did oppose the bill in Transportation Committee, he did not oppose it in Senator Scheid's Commerce Committee. But with regard to liability, and I'm not an attorney, but as if I've listened to these folks debate this, I don't think there's any question about the trailer's direct liability. We're not saying that they don't have direct liability. It's the vicarious liability question that we're trying to address and bring back into conformity with what previous practice has been. And I think Ms. Backus will help clarify what I'm attempting to say.
Ms. Backus, let me put a caveat on this discussion. I think that while it is instructional for us to reference previous practices, what prior practices were, what may or may not have been intended by changes in the law, between last year's discussion and this year's discussion, that conversation hasn't really moved us. It's a good context for us to understand how we got to where we are today. But I think that since that's not been as helpful, what I would like is, in the discussion today, for us to just really get at what exactly it is that you want and what exactly it is that Mr. Carlson wants, because I think that makes it a cleaner conversation without the distractions of the past, the present, the future, how we got to where we are today. Is that agreeable?
Most definitely, Madam Chair.
Ms. Backus.
And Madam Chair, our goal is to clarify that the trailer owner cannot be held liable for the actions of a driver when there is an accident. A trailer owner isn't involved in picking who that driver is. They don't have authority under the current motor safety regulations to be responsible for the safety fitness of the driver or the vehicle. So we want to make sure that trailer owner is not vicariously liable if there is an accident. In no way are we trying to limit a trailer owner from their own direct liability that could be due to their own negligence. In no way are we trying to limit product liability if something were wrong with how the trailer was manufactured, or contingent liability. Again, we're just trying to and that's why we're amending this section, limit it to the vicarious liability statute so that that trailer owner cannot be held liable for a driver's actions in the case of an accident.
Mr. Carlson, and what's wrong with that?
Madam Chair and members, that is what is wrong with that is that owners of motor vehicles are responsible for their use, and that has been the law, and this absolutely changes the law. This does not codify past practice. This is absolutely changing the law as it relates to owners of motor vehicles, and that includes trailers. So the question is, do you want owners of motor vehicles to be responsible? Do you want to make sure that they have insurance? Do you want to make sure that they're hiring reputable drivers? That is their responsibility. That has been their responsibility. And this says they are no longer responsible. That's how we read the language. We're not saying that this is some new concept. This has been the law since at least 1945. This is nothing new. The only reason this is even here is because of the renumbering in 2005. That is the only reason.
I understand that, Mr. Carlson, but it's here, and
yep,
we're all here. So
I got it.
We're probably going to have a new conversation regardless of 1942.
No. I understand.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I hope, again, I used to look at these things all the time, but it's been a few years now, so every time I'd go back, I'd have to kind of go back and remind myself, look at the law again. So please, I hope someone will correct me if I stray. But to get kind of to the bottom of what our chair was talking about, what is the difference? What does this mean? I just like to kind of pull it into that kind of a discussion. If someone gets into an accident in lots of different situations, and this isn't just a trucking situation, this also would apply in when you're if you're pulling a boat, if you're pulling a piece of farming equipment, anything like that. We have within the No Fault Act a list of priorities of who pays first, who is the first order of responsibility if there's an accident, and how much coverage would be available to a victim in that kind of a situation. And the previous law, and in ordering those priorities, we have priorities for the driver of the vehicle and priorities for the owner of the vehicle when they are different people. And that included priorities related to something you might be towing when it was something, you know, a different ownership or a different insurance policy. And maybe someone here can help me going through those different priorities. But by reordering, that accidental reordering that happened caused confusion in terms of the supplemental availability of a different insurance, of adding those policies together. Because usually what happens is you have your first priority and that renumbering didn't really change that. But if you don't have enough coverage, if the person only had a $30,000 policy and you've got $1 million worth of medical bills and all of that, if there was additional insurance on these other things, it would layer on, and that has been the existing law according to those priorities. I think what happened with that reordering, renumbering, is it called into confusion whether you could combine those policies under the circumstances I'm talking about. And now, by combining that with this new language, it would skew it in the favor of not being able to do that where you could before. And in a nutshell, I think that's what this boils down to.
Madam Chair and
Mr. Carlson
and members, Senator Olson has hit it right on the head, and I'll just tell you what the V decision said on that point. And they said that any question as to the existence, extent, and priority of insurance coverage that may be available to any party are not at issue until there has been a judgment entered against the defendant and the plaintiffs have received an assignment of the defendant's insurance rights. Those are all questions that are decided after the fact as to who pays. The status of the law right now as it relates to trailer owners is that they are not a party to a case any longer because they are not a motor vehicle by definition under 169. That's what Senator Betzold's bill fixes. And the bottom half of this language completely changes the law, in our estimation, as it relates to the owners of trailers. They have an obligation as owners. I don't want a trailer owner to hire the cheapest shipper. He doesn't have insurance. They do have an obligation. I don't want him to load it wrong. I don't want him to do that, and they have an obligation to the public. This says they don't. And if you read it, you have to ask the question on this language, who is responsible for the trailer with this language? And I think it's unclear at best as to who is responsible. And I think this language says that trailer owners have no responsibility. It's only the driver. You're going to hear Senator Murphy's bill a little bit later on that says they're making us sign these indemnification agreements that absolve the trailer owner of all responsibility, and we're for that bill because they shouldn't have to sign that. But we're saying that this language and Senator Murphy's bill are inconsistent, because you need to have responsibility on the shipper, on the trailer owner. And that has been the law. And that's why we have concerns about this language, which we think calls that into question.
Senator Foley's been waiting to make a comment. I'll come back to you, Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I agree with Mr. Carlson. My dealing with that issue dates back to 1954. And that situation ought to be resolved by this, but I'm wondering, Madam Chair, if we couldn't take and put it on the table and have these parties resolve this outside the courtroom and hearing room. And if they can't do that or don't want to do that, then we should make our own decisions as to how it's functioning.
Well, Senator Foley, I think that's why they're here, is that I don't know that there is a compromise. It's a definitional issue. So, Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just don't think that what Senator Joel is saying is what we're trying to say. When just get into the world a little bit about what happens. The trailer owner is my neighbor. And he's responsible that the trailer, when I come and pick it up, is an operational responsibility, and there's no cracked frames that isn't obvious to anybody. That's his direct responsibility, the way I understand it. And God help me, I'm not an attorney, so this is, I don't know if I'm venturing in where I shouldn't be. But once the neighbor who's renting the trailer from him takes the trailer to his place, then he becomes responsible for the maintenance of the trailer. And the driver, when you go through, and we talked about this in transportation, when the driver gets to, who's going to take off in the morning, as part of his responsibility, he does a pre-vehicle inspection. You walk around, you look at all the tires, you check the brakes, you check the fifth wheel pin, you check the lights, you do all of that stuff. So then at that point, he's the one that's operating the tractor and the trailer, because the trailer can't move without the tractor, and he has the responsibility. He acts as an agent of the owner of the tractor that's pulling the trailer. The neighbor who owns the trailer has to make sure that it's basically good, solid, you know, but how can he be responsible when he's not even there?
Senator Olson.
Well, Madam Chair, I mean, there are lots of circumstances I can think of without going into the every potential factual circumstance where someone might have a hidden defect or something they haven't disclosed. Something might not be sitting there for a week because someone picked it up and is using it. Someone might have just picked it up and the accident could happen 30 seconds later. You know, so what I agree with is what Mr. Carlson is saying, is that this would be a very substantial change in the law by eliminating potential, and this isn't an automatic, but potential responsibility where the law would deem, as it normally does, that there should be responsibility. And it's also limiting the amount of potential insurance coverage, depending on the amount of injury, depending on whether all the circumstances would warrant that coverage, that we have had traditionally under the law.
Ms. Backus.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to Senator Olson, again, we don't intend to limit the direct liability that you just referred to in these cases. This is, again, when somebody else is driving the vehicle and has an accident, should that trailer owner be vicariously liable. If something were wrong when they picked it up that was the trailer owner's responsibility, we would hope to have that. And I'm just wondering if it would help to clarify things then if we were to strike the language on 1.22 and 1.23 after combination comma and we just inserted an only there and got rid of the rest of the language, if that would help clarify things.
Madam Chair, I think
Senator Olson, anytime
you have any language in here that says one is the agent of the other, you're eliminating the liability for the circumstances that I'm describing.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, as it relates to the liability of the shipper, the trailer owner, they have been responsible. This changes the law. The language changes the law so that they would no longer be responsible. And that liability is what protects the public when they want to hire the shipper that or the motor carrier that doesn't have insurance because it's cheaper. They need to be responsible for that. And it is this section, which has been in law since 1945, that makes the shipper responsible. And it is a rare circumstance where the damages that are caused by a truck and trailer implicate a trailer owner's insurance. But it does happen, as it did in the V case, who was severely injured. And they can no longer collect from even a responsible trailer owner under the current law because they are not a motor vehicle. We need to fix that. This goes a step further and says the trailer owner, I mean, it puts them back in as a motor vehicle on 1.19 and 1.20. It fixes, it gets that definition back in place. But then it goes on further and says they're not responsible. And the question is, who is responsible for that trailer? And the language that we have in front of us says, really, there no one is. And that's our problem.
Senator Skoy, and then I want to come back to that point.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Carlson is using the term shipper and trailer owner as if they're the same thing, and they are not. And if Mr. Graw could help explain this after you or before you.
Mr. Graw.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple of things with that. The shipper, exactly right. The shipper and the trailer owner may not be one and the same. Oftentimes, the trailer owner may be a trailer leasing company. This is akin to what's known as the Graves Amendment at the federal level. And this means that the Graves Amendment basically says if you go rent a car from National Rent-A-Car, Advantage Rent-A-Car, something like that, and you're involved in an accident, Advantage Rent-A-Car is not responsible for that accident. They may own that. If you lease your vehicle from Ford, Ford may be the title owner of that vehicle, but they're not responsible because you're the owner for purposes of the public liability. So the trailer leasing company may be the owner of the vehicle, and this is basically what that would protect is if Dart Transit is involved in an accident, we pick the driver, it's our truck, we're attached to a trailer owned by some trailer leasing company, we're going to be responsible. We have the automobile liability insurance. By law, we have to have at least $750,000. Most carriers have considerably more. As far as whether or not a shipper could be held directly liable, generally speaking, that's going to be a negligent hiring theory, a negligent entrustment theory, and shippers are sued on that. So are brokers, and they do lose on that. So there's their incentive to make sure that they actually do provide a safe motor carrier.
Madam Chair.
Senator Olson.
These really aren't two comparable situations. In the rental situation, you're talking about a single vehicle and which insurance policy is responsible there. And then you're transferring the responsibility, and if you have a driver showing proof of insurance, I think that's that situation. Here you're talking about two separate pieces of equipment, a car or a tractor and a trailer or a boat or something like that. And it's always been the law that when you have ownership of those vehicles, you have some responsibility that goes along with that ownership, and this would fundamentally change that law.
Okay, so that's the question that I want to ask, is that I think there are different scenarios here. As a private person, when I go to U-Haul, because I want to take my college kid to school, I go rent a trailer from U-Haul so that I can take my kid to school. And on the way there, something happens. Mr. Carlson can come, and it was because I fell asleep while we were driving, and it happens. Something happens. Mr. Carlson will come after me as the driver of my vehicle. And if it involved the trailer, let's say it broke off and it went into the other lane and it hit somebody, he'll come after me as the driver for that. If it happens that there was something defective about the hitch on the U-Haul and that's why it broke off, this doesn't say that Mr. Carlson can't go after U-Haul for that piece. So he can still go after U-Haul for that. And he can come after me and my vehicle for that. Okay, so that's one scenario. The other scenario is that I give, but I think what I'm hearing Mr. Carlson said in that instance, Mr. Carlson, though, wanted to go after the U-Haul people for my bad driving. So that would be, he wants two bites at the U-Haul people for my bad driving. If I loan now, instead of go rent something, but my brother loans his trailer to me that he made or he put together or he bought from Menards, and I use that, and the same thing happens. Mr. Carlson wants to go after my brother for the hitch not working, but Mr. Carlson also wants to go after my brother because I'm the driver, but because of my negligence, Mr. Carlson wants two bite at my brother. Am I getting that? Am I understanding that wrong, Mr. Carlson?
Well, Madam Chair and members, just to be clear, I don't want to go after your brother at all. let's take the example of U-Haul, which is not even really an issue that I'm aware of at all. But let's just take that as an example. U-Haul has a responsibility to the public that they are renting their trailer to someone who is insured, someone, you know. And let's say they don't. Let's say they rent that trailer to someone who is financially irresponsible, and they know it. They have responsibility to the public for that, and it's very rare when that happens. But they do have responsibility. And in the rare circumstance, I'm only aware of one case, and it happened to former Speaker Sphygum, where a trailer came uncoupled from a car and went and ran into him. And you should tell him it's a totally unusual circumstance. It's the only one that I'm even aware of where that has happened.
Nice.
And I don't even know who the recovery was against. But the point is that trailer owner, as an owner, has responsibility as an owner to the public. That has been the case, and this says that they are no longer responsible. And so what you're saying is that they are linked in the paper clips, they're linked as it relates to causing the accident, but as it relates to paying for the accident, they are decoupled. They are not jointly responsible any longer. And that's what I think this language to me says. And we've been over this a lot, and I don't have, you know, I've met with Senator Scoy on this several times. We've tried to figure out how that language works. And our view of how this works is that it eliminates the liability of a trailer owner, or shipper, both, to the public. And that's our concern.
Mr. Carlson, in the U-Haul situation, if U-Haul was negligent in not checking to make sure, or not verifying, or not doing their due diligence to make sure that I, as a renter, renter of their trailer, have all the necessary things in place, I don't think this bill prevents you from going after someone like that for that negligence or that not fulfilling that obligation to the public. I don't think. Unless if you think that that's the case, I guess we should talk about that. I think they're two separate issues. I mean, then in my brother's situation, though, then does my brother have an obligation to make sure that, I mean, what obligation does my brother have? Aren't we unnecessarily penalizing him for doing a good deed by loaning his trailer to me?
And Madam Chair and members, again, that is an extremely unusual circumstance. But as an owner of property, of vehicles, you have financial responsibility to the public. That has been the law. This changes the law. And that's a policy decision to have, but that has been the law. And you need to also know that until Senator Betzold's bill passes with reinserting the definition of a motor vehicle, a trailer owner right now has no responsibility to the public because they are not a motor vehicle. That's what the V decision said. They are not a motor vehicle. So as we sit here today, a trailer owner is not a motor vehicle when it's hooked up to a cab. It is not a motor vehicle. That's what V decided. And until the Senator Betzold's bill passes into law, this is a moot point because a trailer owner is not a motor vehicle and not responsible to the public. That needs to be fixed.
Senator Olsen.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. Outside the Capitol, I work in the trucking industry and in truck repair business. We also truck and trailer work, and we rent trailers. And I've been listening to the conversation, and, you know, when we rent a trailer, if it's in good shape, it's got a DOT inspection, everything's in good operating mechanical condition on it, how can it be our responsibility that there's damage to that trailer? Because if something happens, it's operator error. One of the most common accidents is somebody will cut a corner too close on a blind side and, you know, run over, take out a telephone pole or a car or whatever. And those things do happen. But it's at the mistake of the operator. It has nothing to do with the trailer. And the trailer by itself is not a vehicle. It's a vehicle when it's hooked up to a tractor because it can't move. The only thing I can imagine happening is the wind blowing it over or something like that if it's just sitting there. But so I'm interested to hear this discussion, but the point I'd like to make is that if there's a physically DOT'd, inspected trailer that, you know, unless there's something wrong that is hidden damage, how can that trailer be responsible for the accident? Because it's the operation of the driver that causes where that trailer goes.
Madam Chair. Senator Skoy and then Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, committee, we support Senator Betzold's bill that's passed the Senate. We included much of the language in here. Senator Olson, the liability that you have as a trailer renter is to ensure that the trailer is in good shape. And if there's something there that is not, that the driver can't see, then you're liable for that. So you do have direct liabilities. What you don't have is this vicarious liability that the operator of the tractor has. And that's what we're trying to clarify here with this language.
And Madam Chair.
Mr. Carlson.
What you have had since at least 1945 is you have had that vicarious liability, and this takes it away. That's just so we're clear. You have had that as a trailer owner, and these are very rare circumstances where the coverage on the trailer would be implicated. But I can tell you that in those instances, like the V case, a motorcyclist who was broadsided by the trailer, not the cab, many serious injuries to Mr. V, and there is not enough coverage available. And it was not available because of the renumbering. The same lawyer who's handling that case will come here and tell you that I had a case, an accident that happened on July 30th of 2005, and I was able to recover from both responsible parties, the cab and the trailer, and the V case, which happened on August 8th of 2005, because of the renumbering, they were not. And I think it's telling that in the V case, the owner of the cab argued that the trailer should still be in the case. and they should not be dismissed at summary judgment until they determined what happened and who was responsible. They didn't win, but the cab owner wanted that trailer in the case. And I think they should have, I wish they would have been successful, because it helps spread that liability across all responsible parties. This says they're not responsible. That is our problem.
Senator Olson.
And, Madam Chair, just to expand on that, the reason a cab owner would want that kind of shared responsibility is because the bottom line is what it comes down to is the insurance policies involved. If the person driving the cab has a $100,000 policy and there's $1 million worth of damages, of injury, well, then the person driving the cab is still going to have a judgment against themselves personally for the rest of that judgment, that additional $900,000, as opposed to being able to access the insurance policy on the trailer to pay for those damages. So traditionally, there are lots of other cases. If I'm driving Senator Olson's car and I get into an accident with his car, he wasn't in the car, he couldn't control the car, he didn't have anything to do with how I was driving the car, and yet as the owner of the car, his insurance policy is going to have to share responsibility in a list of priorities with my insurance policy. That's just the law. So we've always had a situation that kind of tries to balance the interests of people who have been hurt and have injuries and wanting to make sure that those injuries are included and compensated for, and the responsibilities that go along with ownership. And so we didn't say that you would automatically go and be responsible for something that, you know, that the trailer was automatically responsible for what the driver of the tractor did or their insurance policy, but only in those situations where there isn't enough coverage you would be able to bring in and have access to that coverage. That's why it encouraged people to have insurance on those things and take care of them and make sure that they were operating correctly. This would be reducing the availability of the coverage in those kinds of really devastating kinds of accidents.
All I know is, Senator Olson, it's a sad, sad day when I'm not going to be borrowing trailers from my relatives anymore, because I don't want
That is not anyone's intention. That is not our intention. That's not anyone's intention. All we're trying to say is that ownership has responsibility. It has always had responsibility. And but for a renumbering in 2005, this issue wouldn't even be in front of us.
Senator Skoy.
And Madam Chair, we agree with Mr. Carlson that it's important to put this language in that Senator Betzold has been working on, because that ties you to the direct liability. We agree with that. Where we are disagreeing or uncertain in is with regard to the vicarious liability. And with your example of your brother and yourself, we don't think that your brother should be responsible for actions that are solely your action. And, you know, if there's a fault with the trailer, then that that was part of his responsibility, but not the driver's actions. And if you read this, that's what we're trying to get at.
Senator Murphy, you're visiting us today. Did you want to say something?
Well, Madam Chair, we had this discussion on Senator Skoy's bill in our committee, and it was a pretty good discussion. And for me, it comes down to fairness, because if I'm responsible for Senator Skoy's actions when he's behind the wheel, we're all in trouble. Or vice versa. I should say vice versa.
You've ridden with me, huh, Senator?
Right. And that's what it comes down to, is fairness. I mean, is your brother going to be responsible for the way that you operate your motor vehicle? Should not be. Now, if he lends you his car knowing that you've had, a few cocktails or whatever, then he's responsible. This is the same thing here. You shouldn't hold the owner of the trailer responsible for an action that they had nothing to do with. They absolutely had nothing to do with. And I know that Senator Olson has looked at this law and said, oh, this has been the standard of law for a long time. Guess what? The standard's been wrong. It's called personal responsibility. If you're a trucker, you've got adequate compensation on the machinery that you operate. on all sides. And they're not going to go, well, but should that same trucker be held liable for anything that goes on with the trailer? Now, if they load that trailer with a bunch of, let's say, carbon steel pipes, and the trucker is responsible for that carbon steel because they're the ones that do the tie-down. Now, if they're going around the corner and those tie-downs blow out, guess who's responsible? The driver of the truck. The same thing. On the inside of a trailer, most of the time, if you've got material in there that's expensive, they lash it down, either to the sides of the trailer or to the foundation of the trailer, so that it doesn't shift. Now, if you go, now say if you're a trucker and you have one of those and you load it properly, you tie it all down, it's not going to be a problem. But if you don't and you're responsible because you were the one that loaded the trailer and you open the back end and a bunch of boxes fall off and smish you, it's not the responsibility of the trailer owner. It's the responsibility of the driver who tied it down. And the inverse is true. If it's a tractor driver and they go to some place like Smead and pick up one of their trucks and they drive off in it, it's already preloaded. They get to the final destination. The guy says, crack the back open because we've got this manifest. We want to look at it. You crack it open, everything falls out, and two guys get hurt. It's Smead that is on the hook, and they're still going to be on the hook under this bill. And, Madam Chair and members, this is a good piece of legislation that assigns personal responsibility.
Senator Olson?
Madam Chair, I'd just like to make one final comment about this in response to what Senator Murphy is talking about and thinking it through on a practical level, Senator Murphy. This vicarious liability, if you want to call it that, but what's always been traditionally just a list of priorities in terms of who pays, the practical, this only comes into play if you have a victim that's been injured and their damages, their injuries are so serious that there isn't enough insurance coverage to pay for the injuries on the vehicle itself, the person that caused the accident, okay? Mm-hmm. So the practical effect of this is you're going to say that the person who caused the accident is going to be responsible and is not going to have the ability to access insurance a policy on the trailer. So the victim's going to get hurt. The person's going to be hurt who was injured, because they're going to have less coverage available to them because of an accident that happened. The person who's driving the trailer is going to get hurt because they're going to have a personal judgment against them that would have been diminished by the additional responsibility for the ownership of the trailer. And the insurance companies are going to get a benefit because there's going to be now a requirement for less insurance coverage to have to be paid for these kinds of accidents. And that's the practical impact of the change in law that would be caused by Senator Scoy's bill.
And Madam Chair.
Senator Murphy?
Senator Olson, I don't disagree with your premise. I disagree with your overall argument. We're currently today assigning responsibility to people who are not responsible. And that's not right.
Madam Chair, absolutely not right. Madam Chair.
Senator Olson, I think we've had a thorough discussion.
Could I just say that we have responsibility based on ownership across the board, including for vehicles when someone else is driving them. And so logically, unless we say that there's no responsibility that goes along with ownership, then we're being inconsistent. And I just think there should be responsibility that goes along with ownership.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
I'm going to move the bill.
On Senator Higgins' motion, is there any further discussion on the motion? Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 2614 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 All those opposed say no.
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 I did that.
Chair is in doubt. All those in favor, please raise your hand. All those opposed, raise your hands. The motion does not prevail by a tied vote. Thank you, Senator Skoy. Senator Osteen, Senate File 2875.
Madam Chair, members, I'm here today on Senate File 2875 with Ron Elwood to testify. I suspect we won't be here very long, but I always tremble when I come before your committee, Madam Chair. And this is basically has to do with, I've worked with legal aid over the last few years on working towards some home renters protections when, like, a landlord defaults on a building. And then this bill will allow that there will be a notice that a building is going to be cut off of, like, gas or water or electric, and that renters or a renter could pay the bill and continue the service. And I'll let Mr. Elwood address the bill.
Mr. Elwood, welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. Ron Elwood with Legal Aid. A couple of years ago, when we were doing all the foreclosure work and addressing some of the problems that dealt with the renters caught up in foreclosure, we improved their ability to keep their gas, electric, and water on in case the landlord didn't pay the bill. What this bill does takes one step backward and makes sure that, I don't mean backwards in terms of protections, I just mean that, in terms of timing, and make sure that they get those protections by making sure that they are aware that their gas and electric or water will be shut off. It simply says that utilities must post the building when a disconnection is going to occur, because, this, believe it or not, the statute is permissive now. And I've spoken with all of the utilities. I want to thank them all because they were very gracious in working on this. So Minnesota Power, Xcel, CenterPoint, Merck, and Ottertail, the investor owns, all of the co-ops and all of the utilities are in support of this bill. And just point out one other thing. The League of Cities brought a little something to our attention that we're also going to make an improvement here. Currently, the law says that when a posting occurs, it has to be in the building. And the League pointed out that sometimes their municipalities they can't get in the building. They can't get access, or for some other legal reason, they can't enter. So this allows them to post in or on the building in a conspicuous place so that the residents will know when they come home or in X number of days their gas, electric, and water will be shut off so they can invoke the rights we gave them a couple of years ago.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
This is a good common sense bill, and I'll move it.
Senator Higgins has moved Senate File 2875. Anybody here who would like to speak on this bill? Any further questions for the author or Mr. Elwood? There being none. Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 2875 be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Thank you, Senator. Madam Chair, members, thank you very much.
Made up a little time on that one.
Senator Torres Ray, Senator Erickson Ropes, Senator Murphy is here. Senator Lori was here. So we'll take Senator Murphy. Senator Murphy, we've got two, 2707 and 2469. Should we go with 2707? You pick.
Yes, Madam Chair, and please disregard any testimony I gave earlier.
Too late.
Madam Chairman, Senate File 2707.
Senator Murphy, hang on a second. We're passing out the bills. With the bills going back and forth, staff was just trying to assemble the most recent engrossments, and so we didn't have it in the members' packets.
First engrossment. All right.
All right. Senator Murphy, you may proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, at the last committee stop that we were at, the bill was narrowed in scope substantially. Mr. Klett is here from the Service Station Association here in the state of Minnesota to kind of explain why we actually need this bill. But the bottom line is the clause that is left in the bill basically says a peace officer may take into custody and impound any vehicle when the driver of the vehicle was arrested or taken into custody. And that's just as simple and straightforward as the bill is. Mr. Klett and his association, the service stations, you know, they're the ones that outside of the independents that come out and, you know, tow your car back to the shop when it breaks down. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about people who actually get hooked up and taken off to the Hooskow. A lot of times those vehicles are left in areas where it could pose a public safety issue. Now, if a law officer comes up on the scene of a traffic crash, they already have the authority to move the vehicles into a safe area. What we're talking about here is somebody gets pulled over for whatever reason, and the cop runs their license, finds that they've got a warrant out for their arrest. And so instead of, you know, if you got a warrant out for your arrest, that means you're going to go to jail, you're going to be there for a little bit, right? At least through the weekend. So now you have this vehicle sitting along Highway 94. Granted, it's, you know, off the side of the road, but that's still a hazard. You know, according to federal guidelines, you know, the right-of-ways are supposed to be clear, and the right-of-ways entail the shoulder of the road where you would park one of these vehicles. This just gives the police officer discretion. It says they may tow it out.
Senator Murphy, if the driver is the one that gets taken to custody, but there's a passenger who could drive the vehicle, can the passenger take the vehicle with him or her?
Madam Chair, that's if they're sober, that's correct.
Right. Senator Olson?
I was going to ask a similar kind of comment because it seems to me that this gives total discretion to the peace officer. Mm-hmm. And it seems like that, you know, in situations where it's possible to allow the person not to have to have those additional expenses, that you would want to make that opportunity available for them. Mm-hmm. And so I would like your bill better if there was some comfort language along that line so it isn't totally up to the officer's discretion. You know, something that said when necessary or when required to secure the, you know, the
Senator Olson, why don't you think about that language or work on it while we take testimony from a couple of people who said they'd like to testify. Are you Mr. Klett?
Yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lance Klett, Executive Director of the Minnesota Service Station Association and Executive Director of the Minnesota Professional Towing Association. We come here before you in support of Senate File 2707. We feel it is necessary to pass 2707 as a result of confusion arising from a Supreme Court decision in 2008 entitled State versus Goster. Because of this decision, our towing members have seen significant confusion about when vehicles may be towed off the roadways, and as well as some peace officers. We do have concerns with the vehicles being on the side of the highways due to that. Senator Murphy had mentioned before the road endangers the rest of the motoring public, the people who are going out to their vehicles to retrieve the vehicles. When our towing operators remove vehicles off the side of the highways, they're required to have a safety vest on and flashing lights. Now, when these individuals go out to pick up these vehicles on their own merits or if they are sober or for other reasons, there's nothing to protect them as far as just their hazard lights, but they have no safety vests on. And if our individuals are required to do their job with the safety vests and with flashing lights, then I feel like that's putting people in harm's way. Also is about 3 weeks ago, there's a vehicle down in the Egan, Apple Valley, Lakeville area that the driver was pulled over for DUI, was hauled into the police station, had a sober friend or partner come pick them up, and they went back, and the intoxicated person still went back into the vehicle, and maybe a world record, but within about 2 or 3 hours, this person was given their second DUI. And on behalf of myself and my family, I'd hate to have that my two little kids, myself, ever get hurt because we allowed somebody in society to go back into their vehicle and they're still intoxicated, as an example. Thank you.
All right. And then Mr. Bonstrom and Ms. Furr.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I do have Ms. Furr here, and I do have Dwayne Gregory here in place of Mark Bonstrom. Mm-hmm.
Can they just be available for questions or
do for they questioning? Yes,
for
Madam
questions?
Chair.
All right. So, well, if somebody is directing a question that we need you to answer, we'll have you come up. Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Clatt or Senator Murphy? Senator Olson, do you have something in mind yet?
Yes, Madam Chair. I'd like to offer an oral amendment.
Ms. Backus, can you read it?
Madam Chair, Senator Olson was going to add on line 2.7, after custody, insert, and another means of safely dealing with the vehicle is not immediately available.
Say it again, please.
And another means of safely dealing with the vehicle is not immediately available.
Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins.
How about an if rather than an and? Start that phrase.
Senator Murphy.
Madam Chair, if Mr. Backus could read it one more time.
Madam Chair, members, on line 2.7, after custody, insert, if another means of safely dealing with the vehicle is not immediately available.
So the whole sentence would read, a peace officer may take into custody and impound any vehicle when the driver of the vehicle was arrested or taken into custody if another means of safely dealing with a vehicle is not immediately available.
Madam Chair,
can that be an
if isn't right then?
Senator Higgins?
Madam Chair, my if wasn't right. I'm sorry. I think the and is the appropriate word after all. Sorry.
Okay.
We've been here a long time this week.
If some butts were candy and nuts, we'd all have a Merry Christmas.
Senator Murphy?
Madam Chair, this looks good to me. I think that we can absolutely work with this.
Okay. Senator Murphy, I would just add that the was be changed to is, just so that the two is are consistent. So, a peace officer may take into custody and impound any vehicle when the driver of the vehicle is arrested or taken into custody, and another means of safely dealing with the vehicle is not available, is not immediately available. All right. Mm-hmm. Senator Olson moves that language. Any further discussions on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, I'll move the bill.
Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 2707, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Thanks.
Senator Murphy, Senate File 2469.
Madam Chairman and members, we have
it's all permissive, of course.
Madam Chairman, committee members, thank you. The Senate File 2468 is the anti-indemnification bill that's working its way through both chambers of the legislature.
I'm sorry, 69, right?
2469. Did I say 96?
You said 68, but I did that last night too. So please proceed.
That's it. Anyway, Madam Chairman.
Yes, thank you.
I can address a classic example of what's going on here and the reason for this bill, and then we've got a couple testifiers to also talk about some of their concerns. But right now, what would happen if, say we have an independent contractor who delivers fuel to one of our local gas stations, and they pull in at the local refinery at the main gate, and then they tell them, well, go over to pump B and we'll fill you up. So they slide over to pump B, and someplace on the other side of the refinery, there's an accident. Say all of a sudden that fire sweeps across and burns up this guy's truck. Well, to get on that property sometimes, truckers have to sign this anti-indemnification contract with that property owner, which basically says, doesn't matter what happens, I'm at fault. So if something happens clear on the other side of the refinery or at the other side of a lumber yard that you go to, if you're on the property, you could be on the hook. What this says is that that's not going to happen anymore. If you're not responsible for whoever the property owner is, if you're not responsible for whatever accident that they caused, you shouldn't be held responsible. And these contracts that are written with those kinds of clauses in them, we're just asking the legislature to make it illegal. I mean, in my opinion, this is a way of holding shippers, you know, people who are, you know, hardworking people trying to make a buck and trying to provide a service. It's basically holding them hostage, and it's just plain not fair, Madam Chair.
We keep forgetting about their certificates. Mr. Chalseth.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, my name is Adam Chalseth, and I am the Government Affairs Director for the Minnesota Trucking Association. It's a statewide organization representing 650 motor carriers and their allied vendors. And as Senator Murphy said, I'm here to testify in support of Senate File 2469, a bill that we believe addresses safety, accountability, and fairness. The MTA has brought forth this legislation in response to requests from our members, most of whom operate fleets of 50 trucks or less. And it's important to note that we're not necessarily charting new territory with this bill, but learning from the lessons of others. 17 states have already adopted this or very similar language, and Iowa just sent their anti-indemnification bill to its governor's desk late last month. What's more, the Minnesota legislature has already established a precedent for making certain indemnification clauses void and unenforceable. Minnesota Statutes Section 337.02 does just that for building and construction contracts. I have with me today Keith Klein, who is the chairman of our board of directors, and if it pleases the chair, he can make some additional remarks that explain this issue more fully.
Mr. Klein, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Keith Klein. As Adam said, I'm chairman of the Minnesota Trucking Association, which is an organization of about 650 trucking companies, many of whom are small businesses with 50 trucks or less. I'm also executive vice president and chief operating officer for Transport America, which is a motor carrier based down in Eagan, Minnesota. I'm here in support of Senate File 2469, a bill that's very important to our members. Many provisions of contracts that we sign with our shippers are very important. They talk about pricing that we can charge and the ways we do business together. But we're seeing a trend with some of our members around one-way indemnification clauses working their way into these contracts, which basically say that the trucking company is not only going to indemnify the shipper against the trucking company's negligence, but they're going to indemnify the shipper against the shipper's own negligence. These indemnification clauses present two significant problems. First, they unfairly shift liability from one party to the other. If a motor carrier signs a contract, they accept nearly all the risk in the relationship, including the risk for events and actions that are out of their control. And while it might be easy to say that the motor carrier should just say no to that contract, a lot of these trucking companies, particularly the small ones, feel that if they balk at the provisions, they're going to lose the business. And it's especially difficult if that would happen to these trucking companies, given the economy and the fact that most trucking companies have lost money the last couple of years. So they don't balk at the contracts. They sign them, and they hold their breath and hope something doesn't happen. The second problem with the indemnification clause is it effectively eliminates the incentive for shippers to act safely. One of the fundamental reasons why we assign liability is to persuade people to regulate their own behavior, and taking that out of the equation can create considerable risk to the public. For example, if a shipper fails to appropriately load a trailer and then shuts the doors and seals them, when the trucking company pulls up, they don't do anything relative to the loading of that trailer. However, the shipper is the one that loaded that trailer and is responsible. An example I've got from our organization where this came into play, and luckily we didn't have this language at play, but we have a shipper that ships hazardous materials, large totes of paint. If you imagine these big totes of paint in the back of a trailer, they were not nailed to the floor properly. Going down the road, one of those totes tipped over, and the paint started seeping out the back of the trailer while it was going down the road. A number of cars behind it got damaged by that paint on the cars. And if this clause had been in effect, the shipper would have said, that's not our problem. You indemnified us against our own negligence. The trucking company needs to take responsibility for that. Mm-hmm. You have an example of one of these clauses in front of you. I believe it was being passed out prior to this, if you'd like to take a look at one of those clauses. Here the shipper required the motor carrier to indemnify them not only for their partial negligence, but also their sole negligence, as well as any actions for which they would be typically be held strictly liable. Again, these provisions lack basic fairness and provide no incentive for the shippers to act in a safe manner. I'd like to be clear about what the legislation actually does. It would make void only the provisions in a motor carrier contract that sought to indemnify a promisee or a shipper for its own negligence or intentional acts or omissions leading to legal claims. It would also preserve the incentive for shippers involved in motor carrier contracts to perform their obligations and duties safely. On the other hand, this bill would not establish any new legal duties and responsibilities for either party. It would not void entire contracts, just the offending provisions I've described. Finally, it would not otherwise interfere with the freedom of contract except to assign responsibility where it rightly belongs and improve safety. Again, the MTA believes that this is sound public policy that enhances safety, personal accountability, and fairness. And thank you for your time, and I'd be happy to stand for any questions.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just say real quickly, we've had this theme here over the last 24 hours quite a bit. And it seems to me that we have public policy reasons why we want to have people responsible for their actions, and whether it's something they're doing directly or something they do in relation to ownership, that we don't want confusion caused by representing that someone's not going to be responsible for something. And as you said, if someone's hurt and there's a victim, they can't get out of their legal responsibility for that, but they're trying to shift it to someone else. And yesterday we had a situation where they were trying to get someone to release responsibility that they're required to have to a minor under the law. I think that the theme here is that we want to stick to what the law provides for good public policy reasons, that not only is there fairness in making someone accountable to a victim for their actions, but there's also then a good public policy reason why someone will try to prevent accidents or try to avoid negligence to enhance public safety, and I think that's what your bill is directed towards, so I definitely support it.
Thank you, Senator.
Any further discussions?
I'll move the bill.
Senator Scheid.
Madam Chair, I do have an amendment to offer, and I apologize. It's an amendment to the bill that was an amendment, or another amendment was offered in Commerce Committee, and I'm sorry we did not catch mm-hmm. that we have changed how we deal with certificates of insurance. We aren't changing anything substantively. We're just replacing it with better language, more appropriate and up-to-date language regarding evidence of insurance. So mm-hmm. It would replace the subdivision 2 that starts on line 1.14. I think that Ms. Pontius will agree, and we will just strike the subdivision 2 in the bill, goes all the way over to line 2.17, and then insert this amendment, a new subdivision 2.
And Senator Scheid, this won't bring this back to Commerce?
Okay. Madam Chair, the essence of what the amendment did is the same. Okay. It's just that we are referring more appropriately to the language that we changed last year regarding evidence of insurance.
Senator Betzel.
Oh, Madam Chair, just to double check. I don't see that the A4 amendment says delete section 2. It just
does not.
It adds language, agreements to insure, So we're going to keep both provisions in the bill, the current subdivision 2 and then this one?
Senator Betts, I think we'll have to do two motions.
Okay.
So Senator Shai will have to move to delete Section 2, and then we'll replace the A4 amendment on the bill.
And Madam Chair, Ms. Pontius didn't have the second engrossment in front of her, and so this the existing Section 2, Subdivision 2, wasn't in the language she was looking at. So we're replacing Subdivision 2. So do you want me to strike? Can I just amend my amendment by
Hang on a second, Senator Shai. Mm-hmm. Senator Murphy, are you aware of this, and what do you think?
Madam Chair, this is the preferred route.
Okay. So, Senator Shai, your first motion to strike Subdivision 2?
To strike Subdivision 2 from the bill, 2469.
Senator Higgins withdraws her motion to move the bill. Senator Shai moves to strike Subdivision 2 of the bill. Any discussions on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Now Senator Shai moves the A4 amendment.
I do.
Any discussions on the A4 amendment? Any discussions on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Is anybody here who would like to testify either for or against this bill? Now Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 2469, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor. Any further discussions on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Senator Murphy, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, committee members.
Members, we will go back to Senate File 2690, Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, members. I really appreciate the opportunity to be here. I know you have been working very, very long hours in order to accommodate all of our bills, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate that you're spending all of this time with us so that we can present all of these bills. Madam Chair, before I begin, I have an amendment that is basically intending to incorporate some changes that were made in the House that is very much cleaning language that was not very clear in this bill, and House members work it out so that it is much cleaner, it reads better, and also there was a provision that required funding, and the advocates that are pursuing this bill decided that we could delete that language and come back next year, because this would require that this bill go back to finance, which if you don't want to delete it, we can do that, but that may kill my bill. So I'll appreciate if you can take care of that delete amendment. Now,
Senator Torres Ray, usually we don't really care what happens in the other body. We're the Senate.
Oh, okay.
But since you as the author have asked us to entertain this amendment, we will.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
To accommodate you. So is that the A4 amendment that we have before us?
Part of it is, Madam Chair, but unfortunately I have been told that it is not complete, that the staff attempted to put it all in place, but it's not. So if I may, I would like to read actually what the amendment is. Part of it is in the A4 amendment, but it's I have been told that the staff did not put the whole thing. I don't know why was not.
Members, this is unusual, but I think that if there are sections that are going to be deleted out of the bill, since there's a pretty big portion of this bill that's in judiciary, just to make it manageable, I'm going to entertain the, and they're just deleting sections of the bill. And I know it's not an author's amendment, but I would like to entertain that so that we only take up the language that the author would like to have before us. That would help us. So, Senator Torres Ray, could you go through the sections you would like to be deleted from the bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, in page 6, section 2, the study for children under guardianship and commissioner. So, because this is a study and requires money, that's the only deletion that we want to do. And we will come back to it. Hopefully next year we can do the study.
That is in the A4 amendment that should be before you. Mm-hmm. Senator Torres Ray?
In page 25, Madam Chair, line 18 to 20, this is mostly cleaning up, beginning at the word who. and ending at 14. I think the testifier would like to address that. So in page 20, the lead or the child is otherwise ordered discharged from the jurisdiction of the court. And in 2, insert, or for children in foster care beyond...
Senator Torres-Wright, hang on a second.
Where are we now?
Page reference would be helpful. Let's go back. We just deleted page section 2 on page 6. Now what is the next section?
So we're in page 25 now? 25. Page 25.
Page 25, section 3, which is on the A4 amendment. Yes. All of that is gone. And we're going to renumber. So that's the A4 amendment. Now, what other sections outside of what's in the A4 amendment?
Okay, so in 1 is the lead. Why don't you go through it?
Sure.
Introduce yourself. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, but as I said, this is a cleanup language that I wish we had the time to. I really wanted to have the A4 amendment cleaned for you, but it didn't work out.
So that's okay, Senator Torres-Wright. Around this time, we do what we can. Ms. Semke, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lori Semke. I'm the Program Director for Systemic Reform at the Children's Law Center of Minnesota. The amendment is to Article 3, Section 8, which is on page 20. Subsection B, Subdivision 3B. So on lines 20, 29, we are asking that we delete the phrase, or the child is otherwise ordered discharged from the jurisdiction of the court, and adding in language at that same location, or, comma, for children in foster care beyond age 18 pursuant to section 260C-451 until the individual becomes 21 years of age according to the provisions set forth in sections 260C-193, subdivision 6, and 260C-451.
Ms. Semke, okay. How many other language insertions like this do you have?
That's the only one.
That's the only one?
Yes.
Can we have your language and we'll just go make a copy of it?
Absolutely. And, Madam Chair, I'll also refer you to page 21, lines 21.17 to 21.19 is the same language.
Oh, there we go.
We're just copying that and inserting it up above where it applies to state wards who are on an adoption track, because it's already clear in Part D, which is state wards who are now on a long-term foster care plan.
So the language you were reading to us at line 2.29 is that exact language?
Yeah, it should be nearly identical. And this is language that we did discuss with the Department of Human Services that wasn't in their bill, which had extends jurisdiction to 21 for youth in foster care. It was agreed that we need this language just to clarify the application to state wards and to eliminate any inconsistencies between all the sections.
So we're going to get a copy of that language. Anything else that you want to take out? All right. Members, we're going to try to walk through this. I think we understand what we're trying to do here. So building off of the A4 amendment, everything in the A4 amendment stands. Then on line 20.29, we're going to insert the new language that is similar to that on line 21.17. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair, that's correct.
Right. And strike the language at 20.29 after the comma starting with the or through to the period on line 20.30.
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Right. Members, any questions on that?
It's a really informed vote that I'm going to cast, Madam Chair, but I'll move that if nobody else does.
Madam Chair.
Senator Lamar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When we're extending this jurisdiction from 18 to 21, do we do that in other areas of law in foster care? And are we just making it comparable with other sections of law, or is this something new?
Ms. Emke?
Madam Chair and Senator Limmer, other portions of our bill, Article 3, Sections 1, 4, 5, and 9, contain identical language to Senate File 2855, which was the department's bill that passed this committee, and those provisions extend jurisdiction to age 21 for youth staying in foster care. And that language conforms to federal regulations allowing Minnesota counties to access federal funding for the foster care to 21. So those provisions in our bill are identical to the department's bill, which has been passed through this committee. Article 3, Section 8, and the change there was something that had been overlooked in the department's language that we noticed in the course of changing our language to comport with theirs. And the department agreed that that change is necessary to stay consistent with the changes that were being made in those other provisions.
Thank you.
And Senator, Madam Chair,
Senator,
someone, Madam Chair, there is John Hanna from DHS is here in case you have questions about that. You heard the bill, I believe it was Tuesday, the department's bill that contains these provisions to H21.
Let's adopt the A4 amendment. Senator Higgins moves the A4 amendment. Any further discussions on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Senator Ray, who's going to go through the bill for us?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now we can go through the bill, and I have Ms. Semke and also Ms. Frawley to go through the provisions.
Right. Ms. Semke, Ms. Frawley, who's going to? Ms. Semke.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I already walked you through the provisions in Article 3 that relate to jurisdiction to 21, but I'm happy to answer any other questions about those. The other sections in Article 3 that I'm going to share with you are Article 3, Sections 2, 3.
Ms. Emke, the reason why you're starting with Article 3 is that there is nothing in 1 or 2 that pertains to the Judiciary Committee, correct?
That's correct. Madam Chair, that's correct.
All right. And Article 3 starts at?
Madam Chair, page 8.
Page 8. All right, please proceed.
Sections 2, 3, 6, 7, and 8 of Article 3 are clarifying that court reviews of foster care matters are to be held via in-court hearings and that all the parties should have the opportunity to attend. The changes encourage court engagement of youth in the review process and simply clarifies in statute what is already required in court rules and under federal law that these reviews be held in hearings in court. And I, if the committee would like, I could walk through each specific provision if you like.
Yes, can you briefly just walk us through this so that, because there's a lot going on and I just want to make sure that the committee members understand what we're trying to do here.
Yeah, Madam Chair and members of the committee, Section 2, as I referred to, Section 1 is part of the department language on jurisdiction to 21. Section 2 encourages direct court engagement by the judge with the child if the child attends the permanency hearing. Section 3, relating to the right to participate in proceedings, it's clarifying that right to participate in the proceedings includes the opportunity to attend hearings. Section 6, I'll skip over 4 and 5. Those are the jurisdiction to 21 provisions that we mentioned earlier. Section 6 clarifies that the annual review of long-term foster care matters are to be reviewed in court rather than not in court or in chambers. Section 7 clarifies that the annual review, again, of long-term foster care matters, and that includes the independent living plans of youth over age 16, is to be done in court. And I can point you to the lines as well, if that would help. In section 7, it's lines 19.7 to 19.9. And in section 6, that was lines 16.1 to 16.5. And finally, section 8 clarifies that state ward review hearings, as well as the annual permanency reviews for long-term foster care matters, again, should be held in court.
Are you going to go on to Article 4 then?
And Melissa Fraley will.
Ms. Fraley?
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Melissa Fraley, and I'm with the Minnesota Fathers and Families Network. The provisions in this bill that are relating to non-custodial parents, most of the time who are fathers, are intended to improve how the child protection system treats and engages non-custodial parents. The goal here really is to remove barriers to participation and increase opportunities for fathers to take responsibility.
Yes. Yes.
Section 1 clarifies the definition of parent and aligns it with the family law context and the definitions in the paternity statutes. Section 2 gives the Child Protection Agency permission in a CHIPS proceeding to contact a putative father who's registered on the Minnesota Father's Adoption Registry more than 30 days after the child's birth. Section 3 was part of the A4 amendment, and those lines were deleted. Essentially, that we were concerned that language was maybe confusing because we do have a different definition of parent now. Section 4 gives both parents, including non-custodial parents, the right to be heard in any review or hearing to be held with respect to the child. Section 5 changes the court authority with regard to developing a visitation plan for a non-resident parent who's had little or no contact with the child. In this case, it would give discretion to the judge to allow the agency to develop a visitation plan in the context while the agency is investigating the suitability of the non-resident's parent's home as a placement option. So taken together, we think that these are positive steps forward to increase the involvement of non-custodial parents in CHIPS cases and further child well-being.
Any questions for the author or the two witnesses? Is there anybody here who would also like to testify on this bill? Senator Ray, my assumption is that with the changes that you made in the amendment, this bill does not now have to go to finance, or does it still have to go to finance for
no,
any
Madam
further
Chair,
cost?
No, with the change, it would not have to go to finance.
Right. Any other questions for Senator Ray?
Okay.
There being none, Senator Olson moves that Senate File 2690, as now amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor. Further discussion on that motion? There being none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, members.
Members, I think, I see anybody else here? Senator Erickson Ropes is here. So let's take up your bill. What is the sense? The members, do you want to go on till about maybe 1 and then take a lunch break, or would you like to take the lunch break after Senator Erickson Ropes' bill? Why don't we take up her bill and then let's make that decision, depending on how long your bill takes.
Madam Chair, committee members, I think my bill should be relatively short. This is Senate File 3147. It's a chiropractor license revocation bill, and it prohibits a licensure to practice chiropractic for persons convicted of felony-level criminal sexual conduct offenses. And I believe Senate Council has an A1 amendment and also an A2 amendment.
Nice break. Should I have?
This is the first time that the bill is before any committee members.
Madam Chair.
Senator Erickson Ropes.
This is the second committee that we've been
It is the second committee. Okay, so I don't have the engrossment. It must be because we didn't have a chance to
get the engrossed version quickly. Of it.
Was it changed at all in the last committee? Are we looking at the language as introduced, even though it's been through one committee already?
Yes.
Okay. So for purposes of the looking at the amendments, I know that we don't have a first engrossment, but it is the language is as introduced. All right. Let's get both amendments before the committee. Senator Erickson-Ropes, why don't you speak to the A1 amendment, and then we're trying to track down the A2.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. The A1 amendment, I believe, is a recommendation of Mr. Bacchus, and it's just a housekeeping measure that if we change the law in the current statute that we're talking about, we need to make an additional statement in another area of law. So Mr. Bacchus maybe could speak to it.
Mr. Bacchus?
Madam Chair, members, that's correct. If you look on the original bill on line 1.13 to 1.14, it has a reference to Chapter 364, and it provides that a license revocation under this law is not subject to 364. I think the proper way would be also to have a reference in Chapter 364, which is what the A1 amendment does.
Okay. All right. Senator, any discussions on the A1 amendment? Senator Olson moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion on that motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Senator Erickson-Ropes, you have a witness.
Yes, I do. I have with me today Dave Kuntz, representing the Minnesota Chiropractors Association. This started as a chiropractor's bill, and we realized there was a gap in their authority to deal with licensures for members who have been convicted of felony-level criminal sexual conduct offenses. And so chiropractors are in full support of this bill, and Mr. Kuntz can testify to that, and then we will address the idea behind the A2 amendment.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. My name is David Kuntz. I do government relations work for the Minnesota Chiropractic Association. We're in support of this bill. And we believe professional licensure in Minnesota is a privilege, and it's a trust. And with the severity of the being convicted of felony-level criminal sexual offense, we believe people should not have a license, should be removed. Thank you.
Anybody else would like to testify for or against Senate File 3147, now as amended? Is the A2 amendment now available? Senator Foley?
Madam Chair, I'm just curious to know if the witness is knowledgeable about what are happening in the other doctors, dentists, nurses, and others, the professional thing. Mm-hmm. And also, how is this handled in other states?
Okay. Mr. Kuntz or Senator Erickson-Ropes?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, thank you very much for the question. Actually, the board that governs medical doctors, physicians in the state, and doctors of osteopathology already have this capacity to revoke permanently the license of medical doctors. So we want to have chiropractors held to the same high standards, and they're very anxious to have the same standards applied. As related to your second question, what about dentists? What about nurses? What about physical therapists? Anyone else who has a license in Minnesota? The second amendment that we're going to be looking at, these questions were asked in the House this last week, and they added
we don't,
an
amendment. Senator Erickson-Ropes,
yes.
We don't care what they say in the House. So okay. If you care about this discussion, let's talk about it because you care about it.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Senator Foley brings up a great question about giving the other licensing boards the same tools for their judgments. So Amendment 2 would expand this bill to all the other licensing boards, but we need to work on some language because my understanding is what we're trying to do in Amendment 2 gets to your point, Senator Foley, but Senate Counsel has advised we may need to work on that language a little bit to get to what we need.
So, Senator Erickson-Robes, do you wish us to consider the A2 amendment or not?
Yes.
You do. Members, you have the A2 amendment before you? Senator Erickson-Robes, I just have some concerns that the A2 amendment seems to pretty dramatically expand from the original intent of your bill. And I'm wondering if this should have been a much more appropriate conversation or amendment in the Health Committee. And that if we decided to act on this or do something with this, perhaps your bill may need to go back to the Health Committee. But I would take input from members of the committee on that. Senator Betzel?
Well, Madam Chair, I agree. I think that, first of all, we have some jurisdiction in here, but I don't know whether the notice would have been provided to people who might have had an interest in this one way or the other. When we have such a broad amendment here, so I'd be rather skittish about taking something like this on right here.
Madam Chair, if it's the case that it'll slow down this bill, I would withdraw the A2 amendment.
Well, it hasn't been moved yet. It was put in front of the committee members, so we just won't act on it.
Thank you.
All right. Any further discussion? Senator Betzel.
Madam Chair, is there, if this were to pass, it would go into effect on August 1st. Is there a desire to have it go into effect sooner than August 1st?
Senator Erickson-Robes or Mr. Coons?
Yeah. We could do it effectively when it's effectively signed into law.
Yeah, Senator Betzel? Madam Chair, I normally don't like bills that are effective immediately that affect the general public, but when you have a bill like this that is directed towards a government agency, they would better know that the law has been passed and signed, and then they would be able to start acting on it. I don't know how this might affect, the case that was in the news media or any other pending cases. But if the board feels that there's a need to start working on this immediately, then I think an immediate effective date would be appropriate.
Senator Betzel, would you like to move that?
I'd have to defer to counsel for the appropriate language, but I imagine there'd be a new section that would say that this bill is effective the day after enactment.
Senator Betzel moves the language that will be read by counsel.
Madam Chair, nowadays we don't do it in a separate section, so you would add this language after both sections now, the amended section and the original section. The head note would be effective date, and the language would read, this section is effective the day following final enactment.
Any discussions? Any discussion on the motion? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Any further discussion since Senate File 3142? Did I already ask if there's anybody here to testify either for or against this bill? There be none. Senator Betzel moves that Senate File 3147, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and committee members.
Did I see Senator Laurie here?
He was here before.
He's, Madam Chair, he may be up in GovOps.
I see. Members, I will take advice from you in terms of the break.
I sense that
some of these bills, the rest of these bills, once we start them, we're going to be here for a while. So what is the desire?
Let's take the break.
There may be a deal on mine.
So we apologize for the members of the public who are here for other bills. I see my county attorney here, and she's been here all morning. I know that my staff was trying to be as responsive as possible by saying that we just didn't know when the bills were going to come up and that it might even come up after we take our lunch break. So I do apologize that we're going to have to do that. But we were here pretty late last night, and I think my members are pretty brain dead, and the bills that we have for the rest of the agenda are pretty hefty, and so I think that we need a little bit of a break before we come back to take those bills. So, members, I guess I would like us to be back here, say, at, 1:30 or 1 o'clock?
Madam Chair.
Oh, Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, Senator Rest is here. Can she?
Well,
let's do hers.
Madam Chair, let's.
All right. Well, right, we'll do your bill. All right, we'll do Senator Rest's bill.
It's right here in the top of my
file. Senator Rest, Senate File 2339.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members. I really do appreciate your courtesy with regard to this bill. Senate File 2339 was brought to me.
Madam Chair, excuse me. Senator Rest, would you pull the microphone up closer?
The Senate File 2339 was brought to me by the police chief of Plymouth, Minnesota, as well as the school safety committee in our communities, dealing with school safety with regard to possessing and bringing into schools on school property guns and replica guns. The bill as introduced would have just increased the penalty, the level of felony, from a 2-year felony to a 5-year felony, but in working with Mr. Joe Olson and then again with the
Madam
chief.
Senator Foley.
Senator Rest, could you speak louder?
I'm a little bit out of breath, but I'll hold it up. Okay. Working with Mr. Olson and with the police chief, we took some steps to also clarify the language in the statutes and to deal with proportionality with regard to what the level of crime should be. And so with the amendment, which I would request be added to the bill at this time, Senator Mullen. Madam Chair.
So the A1 amendment, is that the amendment, Senator Rest, the A1 amendment?
That's correct.
I'll move that, Madam Chair.
Senator Higgins moves the A1 amendment as an author's amendment to put the bill into the shape the author would like it to be in. Discussions on the on the motion. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails. Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, I would have an additional author's amendment that would come after on this amendment to insert C and then the same language as we put in with line 1.6, and that would be after the word gun to insert while knowingly.
Senator Rest, where is that? I apologize.
That would be on page 1, line 12. To strike B, insert C, and that's part of the original A1 amendment, after the word gun, insert while knowingly, which mirrors the language that was put in with 1.6 with regard to the brandishing a replica gun.
Okay. All right, we just want Senator Rest, we just want to make sure that council has it so that we accurately get it.
I think that works.
Madam Chair, members, this,
Mr. Backus.
This is what my understanding of the amendment would do. I think it's a little bit easier if you work off the actual language of the bill. If you look at line 1.12 after gun and insert while knowingly, I think that's what your intent is. Is that correct?
Yes, okay. That's correct.
Senator Higgins moves the language at line 1.12 after gun, insert while knowingly. Any discussions? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Madam Chair, with the addition of the amendment to the bill, what the proposal is to bring the possession of a dangerous weapon on school property up to the level of level 4 felony that is in line with the possession of a dangerous weapon in other government buildings, but then to make a gross misdemeanor the brandishing of a replica, and I'll just say a replica gun or replica dangerous weapon on school property to a gross misdemeanor, but to have the mere possession of a replica on school property characterized as a misdemeanor, so that the seriousness of the weapon or the replica weapon being on school property. And we're not talking about people who have permits to carry guns. That is already a misdemeanor, and the felony, 5 years felony, is someone who brings a gun, a dangerous weapon, onto school property who does not have a permit. And with me today are two members of the Plymouth Police Department who will share with you the reason why we're bringing the bill forward and the deliberations of the School Safety Committee and the Police Chief of Plymouth.
We have Chief Plankenpole. Did I say that right?
That is correct. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I am Deputy Chief Dan Plankenpole of the Plymouth Police Department, and my purpose is to represent the police chiefs in the cities of the Robbinsdale School District 281. The chiefs wish to express their support of this bill and emphasize the need to have people to be held accountable who bring dangerous weapons, specifically firearms, on school property. Unfortunately, on a more frequent basis, schools are contending with a greater number of violent encounters with the use, threat, and display of firearms. For adults who are convicted of a weapons-related offense on school property, the severity is set at level 1, which is the lowest guideline for a felony. Raising the severity for this transgression to a level 4 will create greater consequence for offenders and will keep them away from the vulnerable school atmosphere for a longer and more reasonable amount of time. Currently, the sentencing for a person who brings a weapon into a courthouse or certain government buildings is set at a severity level of 4. I argue that a school should be given the same consideration. Plymouth officers who work in the schools have a number of examples in which a student was removed for weapons offense, charged and convicted, only to return to the same or nearby school a short time later. It jeopardizes the safety and the vulnerable student population. If the level was set higher, subsequent violations by offenders might be avoided by lengthening the time they would be kept from the school. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you. And then Officer McGann,
yes.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I apologize for my voice here. I am Officer Darren McGann with the Plymouth Police Department, currently serving my third year as a school resource officer at Armstrong High School in Plymouth. In my time as a resource officer, I've seen an increase in severe violent behavior among students. Too often, juveniles and adults are now turning to firearms and other dangerous weapons to settle their differences. Historically, differences have been settled with a fist fight or simply pushing and shoving. They are now increasingly turning to weapons first to settle their differences. In the past 2 years, I have personally been involved in two unrelated firearm incidents inside the school while school was in session. The first incident involved me disarming a student that was in possession of a handgun on his person inside a principal's office. The second incident involved a foot pursuit of myself chasing the student through the school outside into the community. Fortunately, both of these suspects were apprehended very quickly on scene by officers, and no civilian injuries had occurred. In recent years, school districts have increased spending to enhance security measures in all of our schools across the country. Secured entrances, bullet-resistant glass, closed-circuit video systems, and adding of school resource officers. These are just to name a few examples. Schools are now mandated by the state to practice 5 lockdown drills and 5 fire drills per school year. All of these security measures are in place to provide a safe environment for our children. In modern times, we have never lost a child's life to a fire in a school building. However, we have had young lives taken away from us by firearm violence in our schools, even in Minnesota. All of these security measures in place together are necessary and provide a safe environment for our children. Alone, none of these are effective. Strong preventative measures require strong, consistent consequences, and that is why I originally brought this forward, to make it consistent with the penalties of possession of a weapon in a school as other government buildings. And thank you.
Thank you. Senator Rest, I know that there is the elevating the possession of the gun, but we're also lowering other penalties in this bill. Is that correct?
That's correct. The mere possession of a replica would be at a misdemeanor level rather than
a gross misdemeanor?
Rather than a gross misdemeanor. But brandishing and threatening with a replica would be at a gross misdemeanor.
So we're creating that middle tier of the brandishing of the replica, making that the gross.
Exactly.
Okay. Senator Parasol?
I would like to ask either of the witnesses who have come in and given us their...
Senator Parasol, can you have the mic come closer to you, whichever one it is? Yeah. Thanks.
I would like to ask either one of the witnesses, do you have the same, I'm thinking that, you know, dangerous weapons. Many, many of the schools in Minnesota, I'm not sure there are too many in the metro area, however, are embracing the Archery in Schools program. And do you have the same enforcement there? It's a dangerous weapon.
There is if you look
and
at
it's
the...
And it's a nationwide program that's very popular in many places.
Officer McGann?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, if I may address that. There are several archery programs, I know, in high school programs. Measures are taken to securely secure the archery equipment, the bows, et cetera. Even in our school, we have a firearm trap skeet shooting club where weapons are secured. We do not have a trap range at the school. It is not done on school grounds, so none of the weapons or firearms are stored on school property.
Does this include...
Senator Parasol.
People... Thank you, Madam Chair. Does this include every employee's automobile or way to get to their employment there?
As far as...
Mr. Officer McGann?
Yep, Madam Chair. As far as possessing of a weapon on the school?
Well, I mean, if you're looking for weapons, you know, do you look at every vehicle?
Senator Parasol, I don't know that this bill reaches out to people's vehicles. Senator S. or...
Well, Madam Chair, the current law says that if you possess, store, keep a dangerous weapon, or you brandish even a replica while knowingly on school property, that you're guilty of a felony. And we are...
That's been in law for a while.
We're keeping. We're not changing that. The language. We're enhancing the penalty for a dangerous weapon, but we are reducing it for brandishing a replica, and we are reducing it for mere possession of a replica, and also including with. And I have been working with, as I mentioned, with Mr. Olson and the NRA on this, and have accepted their suggestions, including the latest one, that you have to be knowingly on school property. One of the issues that has come up in the past is sometimes a campus of probably most likely a high school is far-reaching, and you could be walking across a corner of it and not know that you're on the property. And so that was taken care of in the additional amendment that we offered.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and including
Senator Parasol, the
inclusion of public and private elementary, middle, or secondaries. That would include a lot of campuses that we might not automatically consider public schools. So.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair and Senator Rest, perhaps we might ask the county attorney to see if she has anything from a prosecutor's standpoint.
From the prosecutor's standpoint.
Anybody else would like to testify on this bill? Senator Rest, have you gotten any input from prosecutors on this bill? Or heard from them? I mean, I assume the bill has been introduced. It's been on the calendar.
It's been out there since the 2nd of February was introduced in the first days of the session. We know that we do have a fiscal note showing no fiscal cost, no fiscal impact,
right.
And even the bill as introduced, I did not hear any negative comments from prosecutors.
Right. And the amendment is new today, but the bill has been on the agenda. Members, I just want the record to reflect, and I want all of us to know that we are lowering the penalties. So the brandishing was a felony level, and we're lowering it to a gross misdemeanor. And then the possession of the replica and the BB guns were gross misdemeanors, and we're lowering that to a misdemeanor.
While increasing to a level 4 felony,
yes.
Having a real gun on school property, that makes it level with having a real gun in any other government building.
Yep. And so that's the balance that Senator Rest is trying to strike here, but I don't – this is, people get excited,
very
Senator Rest.
I
and
understand
I just
that.
Want to make sure that, you know, we all understood on the committee and it's on the record that we had a thorough discussion on where we wanted to go with this. I have a question for the our two law enforcement officers. Is it appropriate to place a replica firearm in the same category as a BB gun? I don't know very much, but from my perspective, I thought there might be a slight difference. Am I just uninformed? Officer McGann?
Madam Chair, it does concern me, as an example, if I'm working at the school or at lunch, we have 700 kids in the lunchroom, and I see somebody across the lunchroom brandishing what I feel is going to be a weapon. Unfortunately, for public safety, I don't have the luxury to determine at 200 feet, 150 feet, if that's a replica firearm, BB gun, or a loaded 45. So I do have to make that split decision how I'm going to act appropriately.
And the difference is because the replica gun, even if you go after them, won't go off.
Correct.
But a BB gun would go off,
mm-hmm.
And something actually emits from it. Correct?
Correct. Yeah, replica would be a non-firing.
Mm. Senator,
Senator Rest.
I'm not obviously an expert in this area, but it would seem to me that the reason why the BB gun and the replica are put in the same sentence, and I know that if you look on the bill, the current law is there, which defines a BB gun, that it's probably very unlikely that the discharge of a BB gun would be life-threatening. I don't know anything about BB guns, but that looks like a terribly small shot to me.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Madam Chair, I don't think that you're concerned about the party having a replica gun and using that in any way in an offensive matter. And more likely is what provokes the officer to make the decision and actually... taking shooting somebody, death by cop, is kind of a popular thing for suicide. But that's the the other gun, I don't see anybody injuring anything from any close distance, at least.
No, that's true, too.
Mr. Olson?
It's only a replica.
When the replica firearm or BB gun were in the same category as a gross misdemeanor, it might be that it made sense to put them together as in the same category. But we're kind of downsizing the possession of that into a misdemeanor. Do you think that it would is appropriate to now at a misdemeanor level to put a replica gun and a BB gun at the same level, or should we be thinking about treating, say, a BB gun a little bit differently than a replica gun?
Madam Chairman, Senator Rest, I was very happy to work with Senator Rest on this bill. The distinction that she and I were drawing was between lethal firearms and non-lethal firearms. And between activity involving lethal firearms that it threatens others and activity involving non-lethal firearms that doesn't threaten others. And those were the distinctions that we used. And we came up with putting lethal firearms only in the felony category, with putting essentially non-lethal items, you can't even call them firearms or weapons, but non-lethal items in, if they're brandished or used, they're in the gross misdemeanor category. If they're merely stored or possessed, they're in the misdemeanor category. These seem to be appropriate levels of proportionality for the relative offenses. What you don't want to do is get in a situation which Minnesota has been in the past, yes, where essentially the penalty was the same for a toy as it was for a real gun. So there was no incentive for a bad guy not to use a real gun. That was the situation in Minnesota. This bill will correct that. And I think the categories of BB guns and replica guns have been together for at least 8 years. I have heard no indications that there's any problem with putting them together, and it's probably better to leave them together until some difficulty arises.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you for your input. Any further discussions on Senate File 2339?
Madam Chair, I'll move the bill.
Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 2339, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Committee on Finance.
No, there's no fiscal note. We have a fiscal note at zero.
Discussion on that motion. Senator Higgins, I'm going to have Senator Rest talk about the fiscal note if it's not going to finance. Senator Higgins withdraws her motion. Senator Rest, can you talk about the fiscal note?
We received a fiscal note from increased penalties, well, this bill, from the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and I won't read the whole thing, but let's see, where would be them?
Yeah, but the top, it usually says.
At the conclusion, it says it is assumed that in most years no one will receive a prison sentence for this offense. With an average of two offenders a year being sentenced for this offense, the impact on state and local correctional resources will be minimal.
Senator Higgins, are you comfortable with that?
Yeah. So I've actually seen this will note before. Yeah.
Right, so now Senator Higgins moves that Senate File 2339, as amended, be recommended to pass and be re-referred to the Senate floor. Any discussions on that motion? There be none. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say no. Motion prevails.
Thank you very much, Madam
Thank you, Senator Rest. Member Senator Olson is not here. I'm aware that Senator Parasol would like to have a discussion on the SCOI bill that we have acted on earlier. I would be more comfortable if all the members of the committee were present for that conversation. And so what I would like to do is we're going to break for lunch. I would like everyone back here by, say, 1:30. And hopefully by then Senator Olson will be back. And members, I would appreciate it if we could all be back for that conversation. 1:30. We are in recess.
You're looking for in a pile of paper this deep.
Okay.